Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, hi, and welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I am your host, Emma Gunn Wardner. And in this episode, I am joined by the Chief Content Officer of Goop, the lifestyle brand created by Gwyneth Paltrow that started as a newsletter and is now an online publication, physical books, beauty brand, wellness portal, and so much more. That's right, Elise Lunan is joining me on the show. I'm very excited about it because if you think Goop, you may think about jade eggs, intimate steams, and alternative therapies, and you'd be right to in many ways because... well, that's what tends to make the headlines. The stuff that makes you go, they put what where, or they pay that much to do what. It's very, very easy to throw shade. It really is. But there's no denying the team at Goop have created something interesting that obviously speaks to a lot of people. So I was interested to speak to Elise to find out how they've created such an intimate and trusted dialogue with so many millions of readers for what's coming on to now their 11th year. Goop has been slightly ahead of the curve from day one, though, it has to be said. Trends they talked about at the beginning, the things that were criticised even, are now completely normal. The concept of gluten-free was seen as, oh gosh, ridiculous. But now we're all aware of a gluten-free diet. We've all heard of it. We've all even potentially tried it. We've definitely probably eaten a snack that was gluten-free thinking it was not going to make us bloat in the afternoon. I know I have. But they've also been ahead of the curve in wellness generally, in beauty and health, and also how they reach people. They identified and filled white spaces. And white spaces is a white spaces where an unmet and unarticulated need or needs are covered to create innovation opportunities. So, you know, a white space that didn't exist before, basically, whether that's in a podcast or most recently their global summits. The reason why I'm chatting to Elise is because she was over in London for the first global summit based in London. They've done them in the US and in Canada previously. And as they say on their website, we take a curious, unbiased, open-minded and service-centric approach to the work we do. We test the waters so that you don't have to. We will never recommend something that we don't love and think worthy of your time and your wallet. We value your trust above all things. And I have to be honest, that's how I approach the content of this podcast. I think about what you want. I think, will I feel good talking to you about it? And if I don't, it doesn't get featured. Simple as that. If I do, then I'll probably do multiple episodes. I was also really interested to speak to Elise about her career because she started out on magazines and has ended up as the CCO, the Chief Content Officer, of a massive digital outlet. And if you're a regular listener, you'll know that my career started out in magazines. And I know that being ahead of the digital curve, as it were, is not easy. So to get to speak to Elise to find out how she made career choices, swerved bad career moves, and avoided situations where she wasn't learning really intrigued me. And she didn't disappoint. She has had the kind of career trajectory that I would have loved. And I know so many people look to someone like Elise and think, wow, the choices that you made, look at where you are now. It's not a plotted path. That was really smart. And so in this episode, I ask her to tell me how she did it. In this conversation, we also talk about the danger of boredom, how and when it's time to take risks, Goop's ability to polarize, and a lot more besides. All the links to everything discussed and to Elise will be in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. But for now, making her debut on The Emma Gunn Show, it's Goop's Chief Content Officer, Elise Lunan. Well, this is delightful. Elise Lunin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
This is a conversation that, as I have prepared for it, I have got more and more excited.
Really?
Really, genuinely. And also because as I began to peel away the layers of your career, which is really outstanding and really interesting, I noticed quite a lot of symmetry between your career and my career. And I thought, we're going to have a great chat. So I'm doubly excited and delighted to have you here.
Well, I'm doubly excited to be here.
For context, I know I've given you a glowing introduction that the listeners will already have heard, but you are the Chief Content Officer of Goop.
Yes, exactly.
Which, that's quite a role.
I know. Who even knew? Right? I joined Goop 5.5 years ago. From a career in magazines, mm-hmm. like you, it's funny, like the decision to do content versus like editorial, mm-hmm. Is like, I think a testament to where we are in time, which mm-hmm. is like content takes many forms and there's no longer strict sort of editorial, and like you, we have a podcast and.
Mm-hmm. Well, which you host.
Yeah. Yeah, Gwyneth does some of it. I do most of it. I think originally we thought it would be like a 50-50 deal, but it's a 20-80. She's hard to schedule. She's busier than I am.
Well, I mean, who knows what the schedule must look like?
It's crazy. It's aligning stars, literally.
So I want to drill down into you, if that's okay. We will obviously talk about Goop, because the reason that we are even having this conversation face-to-face is because Goop is having its first health summit in London.
Exactly.
We've had them elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. This is our seventh. It's primarily been Los Angeles and New York. We did Vancouver just to try out international, mm-hmm. and now here we are, back where Goop began.
And the response has been pretty... I mean... Even in my small circle of beauty colleagues, there's been chat. Like, isn't it interesting that Goop here?
Yeah.
And it's part of a massive conversation now.
I think so. It seems to be that, there's clearly, we're part of it, but there is this wider wellness surge happening across the globe that maybe originated. It probably, I would say, maybe even originated in Australia. I feel like Australia is ahead of LA, and then it's made it to New York, and now it's sweeping across Europe and taking London by storm.
And we will come onto that. But as I said, when I started doing my research and I started finding out a bit more about you prior to Goop, there were so many things that really stood out to me. And one of the quotes that I want to say back at you, because there's actually one, and you'll know exactly which one it is, listeners, because I know you know me well enough. There's one that made me actually well up. But I wanted to start off with the fact that, and again, I've done all this research on the internet, so if it's not quite 100% right, but working has never not been part of my identity.
That's true.
And I wondered, where did that come from? And because I feel the same way. I feel that I've always wanted to like graft work, mm-hmm. always got to have a task that I'm doing. And sometimes I feel like maybe I'm weird for being like that.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to my therapist about this actually this week, and because I was like, but I think I'm really well adjusted. And he's like, sometimes you can be well adjusted to the wrong things. But I trace that back to my parents, who both grew up poor. My mom grew up sort of in a food insecure home, the oldest of seven Catholic kids, sort of, just, I don't think that she had enough to eat, honestly. And my dad is South African, also grew up without a lot of means. And so they both operate from a little bit of a place of scarcity and a little bit of a place of fear, if that makes sense. Mm. And my dad's a doctor. My parents are totally comfortable, but that was sort of there was a lot of anxiety in my house, particularly from my mom, about like, what are you going to be when you grow up? And are you going to be able to support yourself? And I think that as a child became a part of my identity, where everything was about being productive. And it's really served me well. So it's hard for me to be upset about it. Mm. But, you know, as a kid, I remember my parents put the TV in the cold, dark room and we didn't have cable. And I grew up in the country and we had horses and it was beautiful. But if my dad came home from work, like during the summer, and we were watching TV, he was like, "I'm so disappointed in you. I can't believe that you're watching TV on a beautiful day." And then, of course, we would have to like go upstairs and go outside or start reading. But there was this sort of like push to maximize, not a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
Making it sound really terrible, but like I just read a lot. I used to read for ice cream sundaes at Dairy Queen. And that's just sort of, it's been like ingrained in me and now I don't know how to turn it off.
Yes. Okay. Well, that obviously, that does come back to a lot of the problems that we're all dealing with now, which is how do I switch off?
Yeah.
But it feels like that thing of don't be a passenger, like
yes.
your life. It's a sunny day. Join the dots, go out and
totally
play with the horses. I don't know. I didn't have horses.
Yeah,
play
no.
with them?
Ride the horses. And there's like a lot of beauty in it. And again, it's like, it's hard to be critical of it. But I do think that what has happened, if I'm being honest, is that a lot of my self-worth has been predicated on being so productive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the sort of stuff that like, as an adult, I'm like, I need to unwind that a little bit. Like I can be worthy mm-hmm. of love without being a workaholic.
Yeah. We're coming back to that later. Don't you worry. Cause I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. And coming the reading for the Dairy Queen.
Yes.
I love this quote. My mother doesn't believe in boredom. So you have to be reading, working or doing.
Yes. My mother does. And she finds boredom offensive.
Mm-hmm.
She has chastised my children for even saying I'm bored. And, you know, not only is it, she doesn't believe in boredom. She also is like, I'm not here to entertain you. And like other people aren't here. You need to figure out how to entertain yourself. So that did breed a lot of creativity. And a lot of self-exploration, which sounds like something else, but
we can come on to that later too, if you like.
But a lot of exploration and doing. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of doing. So as an adult, I've been really focused on trying to learn how to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
The being present, just
yeah,
being.
Just like, being.
I'll be chill.
Yeah.
Is it because of FOMO? Is it because you think if I'm being, I might miss something?
No. It's not. I think it's more of a fear of if I'm not doing something, then I'm not doing enough.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I had this, my mom's an amazing cook and I knew how to cook like as a child. It's part of it. Same part of this childhood. Like she used to make me read cookbooks and she really wanted me to be a well-adjusted cook. So I had to read Julia Child how to cook. And make dinners and as part of, I guess, this in this quest to be well-rounded. And she, and then I found as an adult that I would like go to the grocery store and buy things and then I wouldn't make them almost in protest for it was, and I went to see this woman, this is so goopy, but she's called the Kitchen Healer and she's amazing. And she lives in Pasadena, which is the east side of Los Angeles. And I was like, what is gonna happen? And I went over there and she, like made me take off my shoes and we walked around her backyard with her chickens and she fed me and talked to me and like fed me this like simple meal and does some body work and was just talking. And she was like, you know, I spend my time with these women who have designer kitchens where like the stove has never been turned on. Mm-hmm. And like the stove, like the lighting of the stove has a lot more meaning than just like the lighting of the stove. Like women, not the places in the kitchen, mm-hmm. but like as women, we're nurturers, we're feeders.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, you have to figure out a way for the kitchen not to be a place where there are things for you to do, but a place where you can be.
Hmm.
And that was it. Literally, I started cooking. Isn't that weird?
So it took the function out of it and put the fun into it.
She was just sort of like, figure out how to make it a place where you can be. And now I'm like, oh, this is actually a really nice way to enjoy being with my kids because it's open
mm-hmm.
and they can sort of like come and go and like help in air quotes. And I don't know, something shifted in me where I was like, oh, this, I don't have to do this. I can actually find a way to enjoy this and like feel like this is meditative and not about producing.
And did that transpose onto work and other areas of your life?
It gets, work gets messy for me because I really love what I do. And so like the reading for pleasure and work become very intertwined. You know, like I'm always reading and theoretically it's like, it's for a podcast or for a story, but I'm also sort of finding these like moments of revelation and joy in that. So it's hard. Like I really like what I do. And it is who I am.
I know you'll appreciate this. This book that I'm pulling out. But I've had this for about 6 weeks. This is, how do you say it?
Gabor Mate. Only, I just finished Scattered or Scattered Minds. I'm not sure what the title is in the UK. That's on my bookshelf. He's amazing.
But it's the one that I've really wanted to read for pleasure, but I also want to read it in the context of potentially creating content. So it's like every weekend when I see it, there's a conflict.
Exactly. So like theoretically, I've been reading through all of Gabor's books for my own sort of edification, but it also feeds work. So it's,
and you podcasted, right?
Yeah. I interviewed him a couple months ago and like have sort of made him be my friend.
I do that with a lot of my guests. Right.
I'm like, hi, it's me again. Can I come to Vancouver to see you? No, he is an incredible man, doctor, healer, thinker. So yeah, it's hard to find the line.
It is hard to find the line. And the thing I found quite interesting about what you talked about, that, about not being bored or boredom being a bit of a thing in your household, is then going into magazines, particularly women's interest magazines, that the productivity thing I completely understand. And but I also know that back when you and I were probably starting in magazines, it was probably seen as quite a lighthearted career choice or not particularly serious. And so I wondered if you kind of ever had that thing of, well, I want to go and do this. I know I have a great work ethic, but I'm going in, I'm going to talk about skirts.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I went to boarding school and then I went to Yale where I studied English and fine arts. And then I ended up, I didn't think I could work in magazines. I thought I would never be able to afford to. And
rich kids club.
It's a rich kids club. And I ended up getting a job at Lucky, which was a new magazine that Condé Nast had just started about shopping. And because I was a freelance, I've made more. And so I managed to financially make it work. It's okay.
Don't worry, the listeners are cool. We're in a meeting room, listeners. There are some people outside. We're
going
to crack
loud and rambunctious. So I got this job working at Lucky and I was, and it was theoretically freelance. And I was like, I can't work at a women's shopping magazine. Like, and, but it ended up being the best job and the most rigorous training. And it was really important for me because I think I had sort of that like intellectual snobbery thing going where I was like, I need to work at the New Yorker or Vanity Fair and I need, and then I was like, you know what? You can be smart and read Lucky. And I think that so much in society, we tend to be like, you can't be a serious person and care about what you look like, or you can't be sexual and a mother. Gwyneth talks about that a lot, like the boxing of women. How dare you think you can be more than one thing? And so it was actually really important, I think, for me to work there. And it made me a much better writer. Much better writer. Because when you're writing a 40-word caption where everything counts, and you're also writing about 25 bags, and you need to explain the virtues and qualities of each one in a way that brings it to life and creates resonance and is entertaining... that's hard and isn't repetitive. Like you, it was like the, its own weird kind of ad libs, but it was also, you're like really have to stop and think about it. And I think culturally the instinct is to always broad strokes everything and kind of be lazy, but like there was so much rigor to it that it was training I wouldn't have gotten answering phones at Vanity Fair or and it was like the other reason I was really grateful too is that it was only a positive magazine. Kim France, the founding editor-in-chief, like she was like, if it's not good, then we're not going to include it. So like we don't need to shit on things and we don't need to be snarky, and snarkiness is cheap and lazy, and we will only write about the things that we think are, that we love, that we think are worthy of people's money. We don't need to be, it's not a magazine of criticism. And I just feel like that's just a much kinder, better place to come. Not that, I mean, clearly there's a place for criticism in the world, but not there.
Yeah, it's how we should all approach social media as well.
Right. Like, totally.
It's that thing of if it's, what is it? If you haven't got anything nice to say,
then don't say it. Yeah. In a magazine like Lucky. I mean, obviously in the news, of course, criticize Trump all you want. but that's not what we were. It came up at a time when I feel like women's, there was a lot of snark and a lot of like nastiness, and Lucky was very fresh, I think, in the way that it wasn't trashing.
And it also inhabited that space that was women spending their own money, and it wasn't cover lines about how to orgasm 19 times. And
actually give him 19 orgasms. Let's, you know, like how to give him the best night of his life.
Yes.
You know, like that was also what was happening in the culture.
Now, it is hard in magazines, and I get asked this a lot. I get a lot of messages from people who are keen to still get into magazines or start creating content digitally, and they ask how to stand out, how to get in. And you and I probably both did a very similar thing, which was just make yourself indispensable.
Yes, 100%. I mean, and I think that that advice still stands. Like, when I went to Lucky, again, I was freelance. I was working on a very, like, probably the worst section of the magazine. It was like the place where we gave free stuff away. There was no glory in it. And I just applied myself. Like, I essentially, I don't think I was this calculating, but in my mind, I was like, I will do everything with as quickly and as well and as responsibly as possible. And then I'll be entrusted with more and more responsibility. And then ultimately I'll make myself so indispensable that I'll get better work. And then maybe someone will come in beneath me without pushing to give away that work. So that was my process. And I just stretched, I just stretched until I had suddenly managed to get myself like a couple of promotions, but it wasn't through even raising my hand. It was through proving my resourcefulness and the fact that I could be counted on. And that's still true. I mean, that's how I gained Gwyneth's trust. That's always served me well in every job at every level. Like, I just, you know, you have to be indispensable.
Yeah, you have to do your job, do it well, and I think beyond your job as well, wouldn't you
totally
say?
Yes, you do your job and try to do the job as well that you really want while not abandoning the job that you have.
Have you ever been in a role or in a situation where you thought, I don't know whether this is right for me?
Oh yeah.
But I don't know whether it's because I need to get better at it or because it's ultimately wrong for me and I need to get out of it.
Yeah. So yes, for sure. I'd say, I think for anyone who's starting out in your career too, like leaving your first job can be exceptionally hard. And I left Lucky and I went to Time Out New York. And then I ended up going back to Lucky, and I left Lucky because I had sort of an abusive coworker. Yeesh. I know, who was making my life really miserable, and it was making me pan, and again going to my own like safety and security issues that felt untenable to me. And so I'd say that was the hardest, getting another job was the hardest thing ever, particularly if you've only ever had one job. And then what I discovered in that process is like, if I could get momentum going, then the universe would always sort of help me. And that I would never stay in an unhealthy job again. Mm-hmm. And so I have certainly gone places and then intuitively just felt, no. Like, I went to, from Lucky, I went to Condé Nast Traveler, and then I moved to Los Angeles to work for this deeply and glamorous...
Shopzilla.
Yeah, Shopzilla. And I wasn't at Traveler for that long. And typically, like, I like to really stay. Like, I'm a loyal soldier. Mm. And I went, and I was like, you know what? This is not the right place for me. Mm-hmm. And I love the magazine, but I'm not going to be able to do the things I want. And because of that previous experience, if you don't really want me to be here, mm-hmm. then I'm not gonna make you want me to be here.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't feel really productive, then I'll go. So that was easy. Mm-hmm. And then every time it's become progressively easier. But hey, Quinn is gonna have to pry me out of my desk.
Oh, dead hands.
Yeah.
You mentioned then about you weren't being particularly calculated, but if you look back now at the decisions you made, do you look back and think, actually, maybe at the time I didn't realize it, but I was making good choices. I was being
for
smart.
For sure. I think, like, I think that's why, and I also think that one of the things that has that helped me, that probably helps you, is that in my career, I've always known it's time to go when I'm not learning anything anymore. Because I think when you value your career, it's, of course, it's your salary or your equity or, you know, whatever you're taking home at the end of the day. And it's the brand and the value that brand might give your resume. Mm-hmm. But to me, the most valuable part is the education. So if you're not being pushed, like if you're sort of at a point where you're like, I know how to do this job without thinking, mm. and there's no career tracking ahead of me. And I sort of felt that way at the end of my career in magazines. Like, what's next? Like, I don't want to be an editor in chief at a magazine.
Had you previously?
No, I was like near the top of the masthead, but that did not seem fun, nor did I feel like I was going to learn anything that I hadn't already learned by trying to stick around or trying to get one of those jobs. It just seemed like more money, yes, but more pressure in an unproductive way. And so whenever I feel like I'm not learning anything or I have nothing left to add, then, and I think that this should be is true for anyone, then it's like it's time to change. So when I left Condé Nast, I'd grown up in brands that people cared about, and I went to Shopzilla, which was this very large, profitable internet company, this comparison shopping site. So unglamorous, no brand. It was me and a bunch of engineers and digital product people, and it was a totally new world to me. And essentially, I was like, you know, I'm going to do this because I'm going to learn about the internet, which I'm not going to learn at Condé Nast. And worst case, like I can come back to publishing and I'll have learned a ton and maybe I'll love it. And I'm so grateful I did it. It was an amazing job. It was so fun because literally in every meeting, and they knew I knew nothing about the internet, to be clear. So I didn't fool them. But in every meeting, I was like, what is that? And what are you talking about? And what's an MVP? And what's an A/B test? And, what's SEM and like all these acronyms for digital minimum viable product, search engine marketing. And I just, it was like going to college on someone else's dime. And then when I met Gwyneth and decided to go to Goop, I was very fluent. I'm not an engineer and I'm not a digital product person, but I could sort of almost play one on TV. You know, like I knew enough to be dangerous, but I was really helpful because I, as we sort of started to build the team, I knew sort of the basics of how to operate a digital business based on my time at Shopzilla. And everyone at Condé Nast, I'm sure, was like, what is she doing? Because it's scary to leave a brand and to go work in obscurity.
Well, there's a safe brand, a big brand, yeah, a loved brand.
Totally. And like publicists care about you and send you free things, and you go to a big publisher, and I mean a big internet company, and everyone stops calling.
But how did you deal with that?
I was fine with that.
Yeah.
I think like early on in my career, I saw that sort of happening at Lucky, that, you know, it's like people become friends with, and I love publicists, so no disrespect to any publicists.
No tea, no shade. There are two in the room, listeners.
I know, there are two here we love dearly. But I understood that dynamic, and I never really bought into it. And I wasn't a fashion editor, so I didn't work with as many publicists. And then when I went to Time Out, people stopped calling. And so it wasn't as relevant as being at a Condé Nast brand. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And but it was good because then it didn't break my heart then. And it didn't break my heart when I left Condé Nast to go to Shopzilla, when people really were like I fell off the face of the earth. And then, of course, when I went to Goop, everyone reemerged as my new best friend. But
yeah, which is interesting because exactly the same thing happened to me when I left magazines, and you stop getting products, you stop getting the phone calls. And it was a really good lesson for me. I'm interested to know if you felt the same way. It made me realize that it's a business.
Yeah.
And it pulled my head out of my ass.
Totally. It's a business. And then there's always an expectation. And I think I personally like to operate without owing anyone any favors. And we don't really run Goop by press releases. If everyone else is writing about it, then I'm not interested. Like, I work with publicists, particularly in travel or when we need information, but we don't really work off of pitches. Because in fact, the publicists that we work with the most are, book editor publishers. So we'll work with them to book podcast talent or people for the site. But, I want it to be clean, you know, as clean as possible for readers. And I don't want to owe anyone anything ever.
The integrity in the editorial as
well. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And I'm guessing that you probably live by the idea that you never want to be the smartest person in the room.
Never. No. I mean, that's what I think is so exciting about life, is just this, to be able to be a perpetual student, to like understand both that like how much I have to learn and how many, like, that's why our jobs are such a pleasure, right? I mean, to be able to talk to all these incredible thinkers and people who have far more experience in life and far more expertise in certain subjects is such an honor. And I just think of like humanity in general and how we're at the very tip of understanding most things. That's the wildest thing to me always. Like, we don't really even understand how the brain works.
No, it blows my mind that we don't know about the ocean still, like the deep ocean. Like, whenever I get confused about something, I'm like, we don't know what's down there.
No, we don't.
And then I give myself less of a hassle about not understanding how to like work my latest bit of tech or something.
I know. It's wild.
It is wild how much we do and we don't know. Was there a lot of questioning? Because you've talked about having a fair bit of misery in the early days in your career. And I wonder if you ever thought, am I doing the right thing? Should I leave magazines? Is publishing for me? Did you ever were you on a knife edge at any point? And when did you feel, I'm good at this and I should be doing it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, no, I very early on in my career, I interviewed with this amazing woman, Catherine Ross, who was at Prada at the time. And her husband does Dia, that's museum. And now I can't remember where she is. She's very involved in the art world. And she was working for Prada and the Prada Foundation. And she ended up not she was offering me a job. And then somehow I didn't get a job offer. I can't remember exactly what happened, but I would have taken it, which is so strange. I'm sure I probably would have found my way back to publishing. But I didn't know at that point. I was like, I don't know where I'm supposed to be, but I don't know if it's at a magazine about shopping. This was in my like early throes of like casting around like a maniac. But the moment where I feel like I knew that this was what I was supposed to do, it's an interesting question, because I feel like even now, what is most satisfying about my job, and you seem to be on the same trajectory, is just like the new mediums. So podcasting, I love doing the podcast. We're working on a TV show, which is really fun. Like all the different formats, we have a book imprint, and I write a lot of books on the side. So I know that that's, I know my job is sort of weird, like just to get really goopy. Like I'm sort of, I feel like I'm a channel, you know what I mean? Where I'm like just bringing in the information or bringing out the information and passing it through. And then whatever the format is interesting to me. I mean, I think if I weren't doing this, I would be a therapist.
Really?
Totally. I love hearing the way I really like talking to people.
Yep.
I would kind of suck at a as a therapist, because I like to give advice too much.
But I get that. And I also, you have said before, like, you're clearly an empath.
Yeah.
And you also, in the way that you prepare for interviews and podcasts, it's clear that you probably have a similar technique to me, which I probably shouldn't go around saying it like this, but I will. I like to wear my guests as like a second skin.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I can describe
it. Silence of the Lambs of Yo.
I don't mean to be like,
put the lotion in the basket.
Oh, that a friend of mine, side note, we came up with a brilliant beauty business, like Precious Beauty. And then at the checkout on the e-commerce, you go, put the lotion in the basket. It'd be great. Side note, big side note, but I can tell that, and I think you have the same capability of when you're interviewing these incredible people, and you obviously absorb all of their work, whether it's writing, whether it's visual, or whatever it might be, and it does seem like you get into their head.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fantasy, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think you want to, it's like you want to extract, I don't want to waste the opportunity, right? So it's like, how do you extract the most value out of like all of this person's wisdom? Because you can have like a million different conversations, but you know, like how are you getting the best parts? It's why I like you. I'm like, I'll just, I do a ton of research so that I can wing it and just let what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And the channel thing, I just think is very interesting, because with my experience, I've got 270 something episodes up. You've obviously done a lot of these conversations, a lot of research. I wonder what sticks, and I wonder what do you feel changed after conversations? Do you
totally
more than the other things that you've done, more than the other channels, more than editorial writing?
Yeah.
And I know you've done ghost writing, which probably sits in a similar space, but do you feel if I hadn't have recorded that episode, I would still be thinking in a way that might be detrimental, and now I feel like I'm doing well for having had that conversation?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's like an emotional resonance that comes in the actual conversation, and I think that's why audio to this day is still so powerful. Because you're not distracted by visuals. You're not like, you're just really tuning in to what people are saying. And so for me, it's like, I like written content for all the information that like you want to follow up on, if that makes sense, or like the list making. But I think for the wisdom bombs are those moments of like, oh, like that gut punch of revelation or realization, then podcast. And yes, like I feel like from every conversation, there's always one thing that sits with me, sometimes more, but there's always like a little bit of a transformation.
Because it's and knowing that you're reaching lots of people as well, I wonder how you are able to ask, how, obviously, you've got to bring yourself into it a little bit.
Yeah.
But how do you make sure that you're asking the questions that the Goop listeners will want answered?
That's like the channeling part, I think. In a sense, like, it's not like I'm disassociating, but one of the things that I think is really important is making sure, like, there are certain podcasts, there are lots of amazing podcasts. There are certain podcasts that sometimes I listen to because I like the guests, but where you feel like the host is flexing muscle the whole time and showing how much they know or how smart they are. Mm. And they tend to be more the masculine podcasts.
Brocasters.
The brocasters. And what I really want and hope I do is make sure that people feel, the listeners feel like I'm asking, I'm asking the follow-ups that they would ask, and that even the questions that might seem silly or shameful, because it's like that I'm willing to ask those too. Mm.
Does that come back to not being scared to ask questions?
Yeah, totally.
And being okay with not being the smartest person.
Exactly. And not like in no way trying to, I'm interviewing someone because I think I respect their opinion and their intelligence. And I want to, like, everyone wants to hear from them. So it's just like trying to set them up to express that, and then not leave the reader or the listener frustrated that I'm missing the conversation because I'm looking at my questions and not paying attention to what they're actually saying, you know?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Yeah. I hear you. I want to come back to one of your quotes about work before we move on any further, which is, and this is the one that really got me. I spent a lot of time, this is, I think, early on in your career, I spent a lot of time wanting to be seen. It took me a long time to shake that off, to realize I needed to be an advocate for myself, and more importantly, to put my shoulder into it and create momentum.
Yes.
I think that literally, I feel like I might put that on my wall.
You're funny. Yeah, no, I think I know what you're talking about when I said it too, because I feel like I'm almost 40, and I grew up in Missoula, Montana, which is like a small town. And it was like the conversation of the day was about like people being discovered. It was like Star Search and Kate Moss spotted on an airplane and turned into a supermodel. And it was this idea that like these people who knew, which regardless of, not really talent shows even, but that like that being someone or being something in the world was a function of someone spotting you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm alone in feeling like that was sort of the programming. And
it's very 80s movie.
It's very
montage,
80s
isn't it?
Movie. Yeah. Yes, but that's like, that was what was sort of in the atmosphere. And when I got to Lucky and I was sort of like, but don't people know that like I shouldn't be at this magazine? Like that's really when I was so confused about why I was at this shopping magazine and what I was doing with my life. And then I realized, I was like, that's not how it works. Like HR is not going to be like, you've got something special. We have big ideas for you, kid. Like, it just doesn't work like that, I don't think, in any industry. And I realized, like, I needed to make this happen. And then sort of going back to what we were saying about leaving Lucky for Time Out, it was the first time that I realized, like, if I create momentum, no one's going to, like, reach out and offer me another job. Like, I'm going to have to apply and look and network and try to create momentum in my own life. And then only then did I realize like doors start opening. Mm-hmm. Like the universe will be on your side, but you have to take the initiative.
Yeah, you have to do. Do you listen to James Altucher?
No, should I?
He's a really good, he's male, but I wouldn't class him as a broadcaster. But he does great interviews. But one of the things he said is no one wakes up and no one's first thought is, I hope James Altucher like makes enough money today. I hope James Altucher's okay today. That's my job.
I love that.
And that was, I liked hearing it in that way. It was only recently I heard it and I was like, oh my, yes.
Yes. No, and I think that that's what we're about at Goop too. It's this self-advocacy and autonomy over our own health and taking responsibility for your relationships. And there's like this subtle distinction because there's so much trauma in the world and there's so much systemic racism and systemic abuse and like it's not fair anywhere. Particularly in America. And I was talking to, I interviewed Anita Marjani for the podcast in the very, I think she was the first podcast interview I ever did. We went on for way too long, but her story is so fascinating. She had this near-death experience and then saw her dad in the afterlife, came back into her body and spontaneously healed from her end-stage lymphoma. She's amazing. It's an amazing story. I think Ridley Scott like owns the life rights to her story. But she was saying, she was like, there's just a very important distinction, which is that you're not responsible for what happens to you or what has happened to you, but you are responsible to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so, because I think a lot of us get really stuck and rutted in this, but that wasn't fair. That's not fair. Mm-hmm. And no, it's not. But it is still your responsibility to yourself to like try and heal it and move on and
bounce back.
Yeah.
I always feel the not fair thing when I've done it, because obviously I'm a flawed human being. I've done it. It's because I've been looking for a committee to agree with me.
Totally. Yeah.
It's just a waste of time. Just let me move on.
It is a waste of time. And it is like placing blame, whether it's on yourself or others, is a waste of energy. Mm.
I want to ask you about making the leap to LA
and
doing the Shopzilla thing, because that on paper would probably have been not the wise, not the sensible move. So I'm curious about risk taking. And I know you've talked about momentum and the universe will have your back, but that first leap moment when the back of your neck feels really hot and you're like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
What do you remember about that? And what do you take from that you would advise other people who might be on the brink of a similar decision?
You know, I think I had climbed up high enough in the masthead that I understood what going higher would look like at a magazine. And I think like the editor in chief role, like my ego didn't need that, if that makes sense. Not to say that that's what drives people to want those jobs, but I was like, you know, I don't need that. Mm. And I don't think that that's going to make, I know that that's like a little bit of a dry rock. And they approached me about this job. And at first I was like, no, like I am getting married. I can't move to LA. And what's this job? And I tried to like foist other candidates on them. And then in the process of talking to who then became my boss, I was like, oh my God, he's so fun. And like, why wouldn't I do this? And who cares? And, who cares if no one knows what this is and it's kind of lame? And like to me, it also felt like from an ego perspective, like a healthy move to detach from caring about something like the brand name of where I worked. Mm-hmm. That's not where my relevance, that's like not a healthy way to find your relevance. Mm-hmm. And so, in retrospect, it was insane. But I just figured, I was like, you know, in looking ahead, the world will always need content and people need the editing of content. Like they need access to good information. There's so much information. So I know I'll be able to, I know I'll always be able to find some sort of job. And to be honest, again, going back to my need to be doing all the time, I had started ghostwriting books when I was young I did, my first book was with Lauren Conrad from The Hills,
Elsie.
Her style guide, and Elsie. And I did it because I wanted an extra, like, financial security or a place that I could theoretically fall. And it served me really well for that reason, as a bridge, even if it's just like an emotional security blanket. Because when I made that move, I can't remember what I was writing at the time on the side, but I was like, you know what, if this doesn't work out, I'll like write more books and help people help some of these people create brands. Mm. And so, I don't know, it kept me balanced and it made me feel like I could actually take a risk because I had a safety net. And I think for a lot of people, that's really important because there's so much mythology in our culture about successful entrepreneurs and startups, whether it's Bill Gates or any other number of people. Bill Gates did not drop out of college. He took a leave of absence. He was funded by his parents. There wasn't a lot of risk. And when you start to look at the myth of the startup person and unwind it, you're like, oh, they all had sort of backup plans. They all had some sort of security. It's very rare for someone to actually like make a crazy leap and not. Mm. And so I think for anyone who's considering a career move or doing something dramatic, I interviewed this awesome woman, Amy Whitaker, who is an MFA MBA. And I love the way she described it, which is for creatives who she works with who are trying to like find financial security in some sort of business. She's like, you can have all the throw pillows in the world and all these sort of creative side projects and like see if you can get them to take root. But like, you need the IKEA couch first, you know, like you have to, it's really important to build some measure of security so that you feel this safe being creative and safe, like being expansive in some way.
Cause it's terrifying. There's always a reason not to.
Totally.
And can you put your finger on why it was just... I'm sure there were so many reasons not to.
Yeah.
But was it just a feeling in your gut? Do you trust your gut?
I do trust my gut. I felt like it was important. I felt like I could see where Condé Nast was going. I could see that I wasn't developing any new skills. At the time, Condé Nast was like... Condé Nast Traveler, where I was, the editorial team was amazing, like full of incredible characters and lovely people, many of whom had been there for like 20 or 30 years. And I was like, that doesn't seem safe to me in this new world economy. Mm. Like, that's just not really how it works anymore. Mm. And so I felt like I need to keep moving and evolving because that's the nature of the world that we live in now.
And one of the things that you are able to do really well is spot a white space and also scale up.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about spotting a white space and getting it right, because that, I mean, if you do any research on you, even 5 minutes, that's one of the things that you come back with, which is Goop particularly were ahead of the curve with the podcast, the way that they do business, the way that even the structure of the hierarchy of the company, like there is no traditional hierarchy.
Yeah.
But have you ever been wrong? do you spot a white space and do you just think it might not be the right thing, but I'm going to go at it hell for leather until it isn't the right thing?
Well, I think, and this is again something I learned at Lucky, which was that magazine was created and it was a totally revolutionary magazine at the time, even though it makes so much sense. But, the style of Real Woman, shooting real women, putting the credits on the page, high-low mix, like including things that are affordable, nothing that sounds insane at all now, but at the time was not how it was done. And Kim France created that magazine because there was an absence, like there was something missing. There was a white space. Mm. And the way that we thought about it was like, how do we write like we're writing for our best friend? and smartest best friend. Because again, I think that there was a tendency with women's magazines to really talk down to readers. Mm-hmm. And then if we want this thing, then that must mean by extension that maybe our friends want this thing, mm-hmm. and friends of friends. And one of the things that I did at Lucky was I covered tech, online and technology and its emergence, like as e-commerce was coming online. I sound really old, but it's true. And
you're not even 40 yet.
It was desk side after desk side with these men who were like, I've developed this website for how women will shop for jeans. I'm like, that no fucking woman shops for jeans like that. It was so untethered to any real behavior. And so I think what we've seen is a lot of business is still dominated by white men. Mm-hmm. And that's starting to slowly change as it becomes more. It's still completely underrepresented in business in general. Like there are only 33 women and the CEOs and Fortune 500. They're only there's one black woman who is the interim CEO of Bed Bath and Beyond. But previously, there's only ever been one black woman. There are three black men, like extreme underrepresentation, but the world is changing. The world is predominantly female and it is becoming increasingly diverse and will only become more diverse. And the people who understand the behavior of women are women. And the people who understand, who are diverse understand their own culture better than a white man. Mm-hmm. And so I think by following white space, it's really just understanding what women want and tapping into that. So I feel like we're going to see, and all of the research also supports that companies with a woman on the leadership team have better earnings. Mm-hmm. Same with companies with good representation in general, because it makes sense. Like there's more creative thinking. People are thinking outside of the box. Like the synergy is greater. And also they're creating products for behaviors that they understand and for cultural needs that they can recognize. And so I don't even know how we got there, but I think the white space comes not from being like a seer, but just being like in a position where we can make things that we actually want. Instead of a bunch of men being like, I know what women want, and now let's go make this weird experience that is not at all how women shop.
Well, that's one of the things I noticed as well, is having worked on magazines myself, they are usually made by women, women's interest magazine, but paid for, run at the higher levels by men. But that's not what happens with Goop.
Yeah.
It's all women, tens across the board, as one might say. It's all women.
Yeah, 80% women.
Made by women, but also making the decisions at the board director level,
right?
Female as well.
Yeah.
And there was something else I saw that you said about the way that it's structured, is that if somebody is a star in their department, in their particular area, the way that you've structured the business, they will have an opportunity to stand out, which is what we were talking about earlier about being seen.
Yeah, no, totally. I know that kind of goes counter to what I was saying. But I think I think that it's a very flat organization. Theoretically, like we have org charts, nobody really sees them or refers to them. It's not how we work, and it's not how Gwyneth is. When I started, I assumed, because I came from old school media, that it would be that she would want to talk to me and then I would need to disperse it to the relevant people on the team.
Yeah.
but no, she mixes it up with everyone. Like she doesn't understand why there would be like three intermediaries in between. So, and I think that it's so much more refreshing. Things then aren't lost in translation. And then everyone feels recognized for their work and feels like they can actually make a contribution and that they're getting credit for it. And it's not even about the credit. I think it's about the autonomy and the ownership and that what they're doing matters.
It's a really good example of somebody who has had a completely different experience, because movie star, completely different experience, coming into business and coming at it with a new angle. And actually, she was on Graham Norton, if you're in the UK listeners, you'll know. And she was talking about the conversation that her dad had with her after she won the Oscar, where she's like, you're kind of becoming a bit of an asshole. And when she was describing it, she actually used an expression, which seems to be her thing of kind of creating these new ways of looking at something that we kind of know what it is already, where she said, when you become famous, obstacles are removed.
Yes.
As opposed to, you know, you just, you get everything that you want. And I thought that was, when I was doing the research on Goop, I thought that's very interesting because she's coming at it and she's not letting anybody inform her, or she's not using business vocabulary to figure out or say what the business is or what it shouldn't be. She's just going, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. That's not how it would work. So let's try this.
Totally.
And it's fresh.
It is fresh and disruptive. And because she didn't come up in corporate America, like she didn't get thrashed in corporate America either. And so she doesn't have that. She doesn't have the bad habits, nor does she have that sort of, well, I had to pay my dues, bitch. So like, go get my dry cleaning. Like she doesn't believe in that or subscribe to that. And so I think it's made it a really different sort of work experience where, sure, you have to earn your seat at the table, but it's not necessarily through
grunt work. Yeah,
there's grunt work, but we all kind of do it.
Well, that was another thing you said that I thought was great. If you aren't willing to roll up your sleeves with everyone else, how can you call yourself a leader?
Totally. And I 100% agree with that. I feel deeply uncomfortable if I don't know how things are working or how the work gets done. Because if I don't understand that, then I can't figure out how to resource it. I can't help people troubleshoot it. So there are certain things that I don't do anymore, but there are certain things that I still will jump in and do where my husband is like, really? Like, are you really going to sit there? Like, we just did a whole travel migration on the site, and I went through to make sure all the like restaurant listings were associated with the right neighborhoods and there weren't duplicate, like really tedious, banal,
old school magazine,
like
stuff.
Internship level work. And I spent probably 40 hours on it, while we were watching TV, but I was like, you know what? Like, I want to make sure it's done right. If I don't want to put this on the team, like they're already grinding and producing so much weekly content, like I can do it. I'm fast. And it's important to me to still understand how structurally how the site is built and how everything's being produced.
And let's talk about the content, because Goop is over 10 years old now.
Yeah. Can you believe it? It'll be 11 in September.
From the first newsletter.
Yeah.
It has scaled up.
Yeah.
And there's a hell of a lot on there. And obviously it has polarized.
Yeah, that's fair.
Do you see that as a good thing?
Yes, because I think it's interesting. And I think that it is has continued to stay relevant in part because we're willing to have and force uncomfortable conversations and explore things that are new and keep pushing, you know, whether it's about women's sexuality or health or new treatment modalities or ancient treatment modalities. I think that, you know, I think a lot of it originally came from, you're an actress. Like, what do you, you have no business doing anything else or having an opinion about anything. But I think now it's evolved past that. And I think it goes to this idea of women sort of challenging the status quo and a lot of the wellness content on the site and a lot of those conversations really come out of a place of women who feel like we've been overlooked and ignored by conventional medicine for too long, you know, with some grave health repercussions. And so we're pushing and like it's changing.
What's the misconception? Because when I've used the term goopy before, if I've sort of wanted to say, oh, that might be...
Yeah, too out there.
Yeah, I have definitely used that expression before, yeah. I hope you don't mind.
No.
But some of the criticism is almost, well, I can't afford to do that, or why would I do that, or that doesn't make any good, that doesn't make good medical sense. But it is the misconception that you're saying, do this. Is it that you're just offering...
I think
information.
So. I think that people, for whatever reason, assume that we're being prescriptive. And I'm not sure exactly where that comes from. the reality for anyone who actually comes to the site is that we aren't being prescriptive at all. And if anything, we're not inserting ourselves. So we run full Q&As with doctors, experts, scientists, researchers, and we ask questions and again try to make sure we're covering our bases and that everything we do isn't leaving people with more questions mm-hmm. and letting them speak for themselves on their work or on their experience treating patients. And with the idea being, and I think readers of the site know this and recognize this, like there might be things that are resonant in there mm-hmm. for you that you can then take and ask your own doctor or apply to your own diet. But and no, there's no version of us saying like, oh, this is how you have to, everyone needs mm-hmm. to eat this way. And this is how you need to be. I think the whole point actually is like, let's move the judgment aside, people. And some things really work for some people. Mm-hmm. Like if it works for them, like more power to them, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost an anti-prescriptive, like let's everyone's different mm-hmm. and we all need different things. And that I think is also threatening because in that there's implied a certain amount of self-autonomy and sort of going back to what we were mm-hmm. saying, like my health is my responsibility. And my doctor's not going to keep me well, not in the way that Western medicine is practiced in the United States, at least. Like, it's my job to keep myself
because
well.
Because of accessibility and eligibility and cost and...
Yeah, like, we don't really, in the U.S. at least, we're terrible at preventative medicine. Mm. You really don't go and see a doctor. I mean, you go for your annual pap smear, but you really don't go and see the doctor until you're sick and you have a diagnosis code. Mm. You don't go with this idea of like maintaining vitality, and particularly for women, like you have a baby and you're depleted, and then maybe you have another and then you're really depleted, and no one really pays attention to you or listens to you or looks into what might be going on with you until you have like a full-blown autoimmune disease.
Right. Yeah.
There's no, and you guys are way ahead of us because you have paid maternity leave. We don't even have paid family leave in the United States.
I know all of my friends who've moved to America and then had babies. They're like, oh, I was on maternity leave for 6 weeks. I'm like, what?
And they were probably unpaid, you know, like it's up to your employer to pay you. And most companies or a lot of companies, not most actually, Goop, a lot of tech companies, like we pay maternity leave. Some companies like Netflix will pay for a year to give the equivalent of what people in the UK get. But most companies and most people in America are hourly workers. They do not get a single paid hour to have a baby. It is insane. Yikes. It's criminal. And it traps people in poverty, and it's terrible for kids and families. And we really need help. Like we really need policy changes and legislation, but it's an example of just like how women in particular in America are sort of ignored until there's like a real health crisis.
That's what really struck me when I was researching, and somebody wrote a brilliant piece where they just essentially said, Goop is at the zenith of this wellness complex. And one of the reasons is it's a place where actually you can be seen, you can be heard, it's kind. Mm-hmm. You can ask an embarrassing question, what might be seen as an embarrassing question, and you can arm yourself with information.
Yeah.
Not everything might work for you. Not all of the solutions might be up your street. But then what you've said about it is you credit your reader with intelligence.
Totally. That's yes.
Which I think is the missing piece in the criticism.
Yes. And so much of the criticism is it's very misogynist and it's very embedded in the culture to the point where I think people don't even recognize it, which is this idea that they assume that women are lemmings and that if Gwyneth Paltrow thinks that you should eat this way, that everyone's just rushing to eat that way. And that is not how women function. Like we are perfectly capable of reading something, assessing it, parsing it, and saying, like this is resonant for me, or that might actually be what's happening, or not for me. It's so a kind of patronizing this idea that, and it's kind of hilarious too, that people believe that we're so prescriptive or so have so much authority, and women have such an inability to determine, make decisions for themselves that that we need to be contained in some way. When really it's like, here's some information. We think this is important and interesting. Take it or leave it.
Yeah. This
without is judgment. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's what we know about it.
Totally. Yeah. We think this is really interesting. It has credence. There's some really promising science.
Well, it's the labeling as well. Did you go do that?
Yeah.
Did it take 40 hours in front of the TV?
Oh, the...
the labeling.
Like ancient modality, speculative but interesting. Yeah. And we did that not really for our readers who completely understand where we're going from, coming from, but we did it just for the wider public to be like, very clear, this is like an ancient modality, or this is rigorously backed by science, or this is speculative but interesting. Again, I think just this underlining of people get it, but if you need to make sure that women understand, here you go. Here's a billboard.
Now, there is a new way to enjoy Goop content, which is the Netflix show.
Yeah.
Which is happening. Is it around the time of the 11th birthday?
No, it'll come out next year.
Okay.
Yeah. I wish it were coming out.
And is it going to be similar to the podcast? Is it going to be like editorialized conversations with experts?
A little bit. It's a wellness, like wellness mini docs.
Wellness mini docs. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. It's a different format. It'll be a little different, but I still think it'll feel like very goopy.
Mm-hmm. And if you had to define goopy.
What's goopy?
What's goopy?
That's a great question. What is goopy? I mean, I think it's like, if I were to define it as a reader type of person, it's like anyone who's sort of interested in asking questions, not challenging the status quo just to challenge the status quo, but literally wanting to understand, like, where does this come from? And what's the foundation of this? And could I have a better relationship with my mother? And do I fight with my husband in a bad way? Like, it's sort of that. It's like the person who I think has a lot of curiosity about the way that things are done and whether they could be done better.
Room, almost like the room to grow. Like, could I improve this area of my life? Even if it's improving what I eat so that I don't bloat. As simple
totally.
As that.
As simple as that. And that's what I think is fun about Goop, is that there are people who are new to the brand who come because they're like, oh, like being chronically constipated isn't how you're supposed, isn't normal. And then they sort of start there. And then there are the people who are like, oh, I don't eat lectins and I have a medium, and who are just like beyond goopy, you know, like driving the boat in terms of what's next in wellness.
But that's the thing. I've had a couple of nutritionists on this podcast who have said that someone will eventually come and see them and she'll say, so how long have you been having digestive issues? And they'll be like, oh, 16 years.
Yeah.
Because somebody has said to them, you know that that's not normal and you know it's okay to go and check it out.
Right.
Which is kind of channeling what you're saying. You can just, you can find out, you can read an article and find out that maybe this thing that you've been putting up with or just assumed was normal might be something you can take action on.
Totally. And I think that people accept things as normal that are deeply unnormal. I mean, that's how my husband was when I met him. Like, the worst gas, like, just, I was like, this is not normal. And he's like, no, it is normal. I've always been like this. I'm like, just because you've always been like this and your dad was like this doesn't mean that it's normal. And sure enough, like, I was like, just humor me. This is even before I got to Goop. I was like, let's take out gluten. And we took out, because he was so addicted to carbs. And we took out gluten, and he's already a thin guy, but he had like a kind of a tummy. And within like 2 weeks, he had lost like 15 pounds. This is why men suck. But he'd lost like 15 pounds, had no digestive issues. And he was like, oh my God. But he thought I was crazy until I actually got him to do it.
It's interesting. It's all really interesting stuff. And obviously so interesting that people are flying to London. I know people have, one of the first conferences, some people flew across America.
Yeah.
Because it was the only place where they could have a proper conversation about their autoimmune disease, or felt that they could have a proper conversation.
Yeah, no, it's become, these summits have become places of community. And at the last one in Los Angeles, there was a woman who had become my friend on Instagram, because she's from Idaho and I'm from Montana, and she was like, where do you, how do you talk about this stuff in Montana when you're home because people think I'm batshit crazy. And so she came to the summit and was with a woman from Portland, and like people commune and can, yeah, like find people who understand what they're talking about and are interested in the same things. A group of women came from Australia to LA who were hilarious and so much fun. And it's really, they're really powerful days. And, you know, it's expensive because they're like weddings. They're so, we put so much energy into creating these amazing days. And like the gift bag is always worth more than the value of the ticket. Mm. And like the women from Australia and LA were, the one was saying at the end, she was like, you know, I was so nervous about doing this because I thought like I'm flying across the world and I'm spending a lot of money to do this experience. And what if it's terrible? And then she was like, but literally like it was worth it in the first 10 minutes. And I was like, thank you. That is the nicest compliment. She's like, one event, one moment of it made it worth it. Cause I think sometimes it's like those small one, I think it's the community and being feeling seen.
Yeah.
And then it's also like that, the podcast nuggets or like that one panel or the one class where something in you shifts.
I would say you might have heard something a million times before, but it's hearing it in the right context in the right moment where suddenly it's like, boom.
Like that person's talking to me. Yes.
And that's now I get it. And now everything's different.
Totally.
It was great. Well, I need to let you get off to your summit.
Ooh.
thank you so much for joining me. Listeners, obviously everything that has been discussed will be in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this podcast. I will put links to Elise in the show notes as well. Please do read up on her. Please do follow her on social. Please engage with her.
Thank you.
It's actually been super, not just fun talking to you, but researching, wearing you like Buffalo Bill. You're in the well. It was really pleasurable.
I hope the lotion is non-toxic and Goop approved.
Yes, I will have to upgrade my dungeon cosmetics another time. But anyway, before this gets too mad, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Emma.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed that episode of the podcast. If you wanted to get in touch with me, it literally couldn't be easier. Just email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com, or please do go over to Instagram or Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns, and just send me a DM. I'd love to hear from you. If you want to maybe chat to me and other listeners of the show, then do click the link in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode, and click the link to join the Facebook group, Answer Two Questions, and there you will find thousands of other listeners keen to have a conversation with you about this episode and more. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate your time, and I cannot wait to see you on the next one.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.